Course text. So I've talked to you about the one reading that's up here, the first one, and chronology document. So please notice that I call this a work in progress. So about a month ago, it occurred to me, well, it would be helpful for you, for the students in this course now and in the future, if I could identify events, if I could lay out a chronology of globalization since 1492 and describe actual episodes, identify episodes that are part of this process of globalization since 1492. And as I got into it, the task sort of grew and grew. It also occurred to me that this might work very well on the internet, that this kind of bullet writing seems to be what the internet likes. So this is gives you some grounding. Now, I want to say that you might find my approach a little bit frustrating. This course and this initiative, after all, is associated with globalization. And globalization is a pretty big concept. It's kind of a generalization disguised as a specialty, you might say. So, you know, the way the university has been set up so that, well, this department deals with the past, history. This department deals with culture, anthropology. This department deals with society, sociology. This department deals with places and space, geography. This department deals with life forms, you know, biology. This department deals with the mind. So, you know, this has been a powerful way to pursue knowledge and to break up and divide the universe into succinct sections and then to develop specialties in these sections. To get a PhD, you have to show deep knowledge in a very narrowly circumscribed field. My PhD thesis, which I finished at the University of Toronto in 1984 in the Department of History, was called Land, Law, and the Lord in the Indian Affairs of Upper Canada, 1791 to 1858. So you see that I've kind of left that format in a way. So as I see it, globalization studies, to be true to the reality of how globalization is proceeding, I mean, there's all kinds of new mergers taking place where people move around, they come into contact with each other. Sometimes one group prevails, sometimes the other group prevails, but very often people will get together and combine and create new cultural experiments. The internet, you go exploring and you go off on this direction and that direction. Google is an amazing instrument. It changes everything. I mean, it used to be that, you know, to become knowledgeable in something, you might have to go to a certain archive. You might have to arrange to go to a certain archive in Germany or in Waterloo, Ontario, or London, England, or or Greenland, and you know, the knowledge was contained in files, and you know, suddenly now with Google, it's there it is, and you can develop specialties that might have taken you months or years in an afternoon on Google. It's not to say that everything's on the internet. It's not to say that, you know, there isn't lots of need for people to go off and explore archives and things in a very specialized way. But as I see it, this sort of adventuring and going into other fields and empowering yourself in a sense to take the whole world as your the place where you live and identify with all of humanity. I think, for instance, if you really see humanity as a single polity, as a family, you can't make distinctions between international war or foreign wars. It's all civil wars. Every war is a civil war. So as I see it, there is a need to be true to what this study, the potential of this study, and we're just knocking at the door, I think, of it. It's just early, you know, an early effort at a start, but you know, for this study to proceed in a way that is true to the spirit of globalization, it has to be, there has to be a certain flexibility, a certain sense of adventure to go into territories, to look at, to put, say, individuals together that might not meet in this context and have them talk. So in these lectures, I try to break out of a narrow sense of specialization and explore and go and look at things that, you know, didn't, I wasn't encouraged to do so when I was working on a PhD developing my specialized knowledge in the history of Indian affairs in Upper Canada, 1758 to 1791 to 1858. And I usually bring in about 10 times more material than I actually cover, because I think maybe I'll go in this direction, maybe I'll go in that direction. But you know, you're in a course and you're going to be thinking about your test and getting your credit, and that's very important. So hopefully this is a kind of step forward, and this gives you some grounding here. I'll continue to work on this. I'll continue to update this. Chronology, but okay, Russia, Great Britain, Spain, just to pick one at random, and the United States on the Pacific Ocean and the Pacific Rim. As I was writing this and using Google and getting out this great big book here, can we go over here, the World History, picked this up before Christmas, National Geographic, highly illustrated, really intense, and lo and behold, they end with the concept of globalization. And if we have time, I might go into that definition there. But in any case, here's an example of, you know, how he's trying to pull things together from different studies. It would be hard to find, I think, this essay in another book. It would separate the subjects. You know, I'm trying to bring subjects together, create convergences. So in 1741, in the Great Northern Expedition, Vitus Bering explores the northeastern extremes of Asia and parts of the west coast of North America for Russia. This assertion of Russian influence helps motivate Alexander Mackenzie of the Montreal-based Northwest Company. And as I'm doing this, I'm thinking, well, of course, all these phrases can be links, right? Like as we develop this, Northwest Company, click. You want to find out about the Northwest Company. You want to find out about Alexander Mackenzie. Click, 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 click. I mean, that's the logic of the internet. That's how you go on the internet. You link, you connect. So use these key words. This assertion of Russian influence helps motivate Alexander Mackenzie of the Montreal-based Northwest Company to accelerate his explorations. In 1789, Mackenzie reaches the Arctic Ocean, and then I'll just rush through this. It's going to take too long to read it, but so the Russians moving into Alaska motivate the Spanish to move northward. They establish San Francisco in 1775, Nootka in present-day British Columbia in 1789. The Russian-American Fur Company is chartered in 1799. So this draws a lot of attention to the Pacific. Bougainville goes to Tahiti. Bougainville concentrates much attention on Tahiti, which he describes as a kind of earthly paradise, like the writings of Baron de La Hontan, who published prolific romanticized accounts of the innocent wisdom of the Indians in the French colony of Canada. Bougainville's description of Tahiti as a domain of noble savages helps steer the intellectual current of the French Enlightenment towards a preoccupation with nature and natural life as a corrective to the corruptions and rot of overly mature civilization. So, you know, Bougainville's writings, he writes in France about these marvelous, wonderful, pure, pristine, noble savages in Tahiti. And then these philosophers in France sort of fantasize about that. And this becomes part of the critique of what about our corrupt monarchy and our overripe civilization. So the French Revolution and the ideas that lead to the French Revolution are connected to these explorations. So, you know, the effort is to try to see the big picture, the global picture. So I'm talking about facts, I suppose, but I'm more trying to give you a sense of the methodology here, a way of approaching knowledge. And of course, the effort is to connect things, to see the interactivity, to see how to break out of the way we've broken up knowledge and we've divided the world into little discrete pieces. But in fact, you know, as we have our history, our anthropology, our sociology, our political science, our biology, you know, the world in fact isn't constructed that way. The world is all of a whole. Captain James Cook, Cook is killed in 1779 by indigenous people in Hawaii. In the War of 1812, subsequently Great Britain and the United States test their overlapping claims to Oregon, which is part of the Pacific Rim. In 1846, the division of North America between these sovereign governments is continued when the international boundary along the 49th parallel is extended from the height of the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific coast. Takes me into Alaska being sold to the United States in 1867. The thinking was they're going to get British North America. Now they've got British North America. You know, they've got them on one extreme, and on the other extreme, the United States is eventually going to absorb British North America. But of course, you know, it raises the issue. Well, so Russia sells Alaska to the United States. What about the indigenous people of Alaska, the people who've lived there for thousands of years? They get no say in this whatsoever. That was my point when we went to Quebec City in 2001. What does every country in the Western Hemisphere have in common? It's all on land that was Indian land. Indian people are still around. Are Indian people represented as Indian people at the as nations of Indian people in the changing of the configurations of economics and politics with the free trade area of the Americas? So it's the same general approach as in 1867, or when Louisiana is sold by Napoleon to the government of Thomas Jefferson, the United States of America. Or for that matter, when the territory that we're on now is sold by the Hudson's Bay Company to the Dominion of Canada in 1869-70. Louis Riel comes along and says, hey, we're people, we're not deer, we're not trees. We live here, what about us? He ends up being hanged in 1885. You know, the person who could have been negotiating, the person who symbolized, in a sense, who was in the center of this tension between French, English, newcomer Aboriginal, East, West, you know, Catholic, Protestant, the person right in the very center of it who could have been a mediator, gets criminalized and ultimately hanged. So in any case, I draw this to your attention, and so I'm conscious of the need to make this manageable to you. So, you know, when we get to the midterm test, I'll be identifying. Usually I ask, describe and give the significance and give a choice of maybe 12 terms, choose 5 of them or whatever. And I'll give you plenty of warning. But I don't want, you know, when I lecture, I want to keep a certain sense of being able to try to connect things and see comparisons between time periods and being able to move between regions and cultures in the way I'm talking. And so that might be kind of hard to follow, but But it seems to me that you can't really do globalization studies. It's not really a specialty. It's more an effort at synthesis. It's more an effort, I think, to try to reassemble the world that we've taken apart, and we've achieved a lot of things in that way. But an ecological approach has to deal with the reality that it's all connected, and that we can't just isolate certain things and or fix certain societies and leave other societies to go by the wayside. And we've done lots of that, essentially relegating societies to the dust heap of history. And why are there only 6,000 languages when there were 12,000? And in 50 years, will there be 50 languages? And monocultures versus biodiversity. But at the same time, we're all human. We all share much more in common than differentiates us. And we need vehicles of government, of law, that will deal with the things that we share in common, like the reality of global warming. You know, the Kyoto Treaty is an effort by a big chunk of humanity to come up with some collective approach, because global warming isn't going to stop in, we're not going to have an Alberta solution or a Canadian solution of, you know, the 49th parallel, the clouds don't respect it, the life cycles don't respect it. Obviously, we have to find a way to create some kind of governance at a higher level and upload powers to that government, but also download other kind of powers so that we can maintain some kind of diversity among ourselves. And, you know, the thing about monocultures is you get a foreign blight, a certain virus, and if all your wheat or your pine trees, they're all cousins, they're all first cousins, they're all the same age, they all come from the same genetic pool, essentially cousins. If there's a vulnerability, everybody, they're all going to go down. So the way life adapts is, well, there's a range of genetic types, and there's a range of species, and if part of the system collapses, then other parts can react and can adapt and fend off the virus or whatever it is. Couldn't we conceive, if humanity becomes a monoculture and an idea takes root and we have no way to sort of, it's a toxic idea, but we have no way to counteract it, no range of ideas to draw upon or cultures to draw upon. So how do we, you know, in a sense, embrace what is universal among us, which is one of the great, I think, challenges of being human, that you can see this flickering through history. You know, we're Russians, we're Germans, we're Japanese, but there's something about us that is all the same, and how do we reflect that in the way we govern ourselves and make our laws? On the other hand, what's different about us is also very precious and can actually be very fruitful. So